Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Rolling Stone executive editor Nathan Brackett. Today we're going to talk about musicians and politics. When is it a good idea for rock and rollers and other musicians to get involved with activism, and when isn't it? We're also going to talk about what we're listening to in the office and answer some reader mail. But first, today's episode of Rolling Stone Music Now is brought to you by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. Sign up for Stamps.com and get a 4-week trial and $110 bonus offer when you use the promo code MUSIC. We're going to talk about what we're listening to in the office. I'm here with John Dolan, Record Reviews editor at Rolling Stone, and Susie Exposito, Rolling Stone contributor and producer at RollingStone.com. Thanks for coming, guys.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to first talk about a shoegaze band with an awesome name called Pity Sex. Susie, you brought this song to the table, and I'm loving it.
Yeah. The song is called Pin a Star. It was premiered last week. Pity Sex, I've been following them since 2012. They released this EP called Dark World, and it was definitely more on the emo side of things. And since then, they've evolved immensely. Their last record was called Feast of Love. That's when they kind of took this shoegazy turn. They do this really lovely, like, male-female vocal trade-off between the two guitarists, Brennan Graves and Brittany Drake, who has a really hilarious Twitter account. Lots of, like, dog and cat pictures.
Good to know.
Specifically, dog wearing a hat.
Even better. Is it like an emo hat? Or
lately, the dog has been wearing this really funky, like, red snow cap. I don't know how else to describe it.
This is, I will say, if I could jump in, this is my favorite kind of shoegaze music because it's definitely got, like, a melody and a little, like, a purpose. It's not just, like, pure shoegaze atmospheric kind of dreamscapes. It's, like, there's definitely a drive to this song, which I'm liking a lot.
They don't really do the wall of sound thing. They're a lot more melodic, a little bit pop, especially in this new song. I've listened to the upcoming record, White Hot Moon, and it really reminds me of, like, Lush meets the Lemonheads. Mm-hmm. The Lemonheads specifically because they have these, like, real kickers, you know, like...
Right, that's the melodic side, yeah.
Yeah, they have these pop structures, you know, but then... infuse a little bit of the noisy sprawl of shoegaze. So,
all right, well, worth keeping an eye on. Pity Sex in their shoegaze phase.
Mm-hmm.
John, you brought a song from Kate Le Bon. She's a Welsh singer-songwriter, right, who used to be with the Super Furry Animals?
Yeah, who are a kind of 90s, already kind of Brit rock band. And yes, Welsh, now she lives in Los Angeles. This is her, I guess, fifth solo record, and it's called Crab Day, and it's just fantastic. It's a great record. The musical references are sort of late 70s British post-punk, like the Raincoats and the Au Pairs. Sometimes some of the guitar stuff reminds me of New York, kind of early CBGB's Television and Richard Hell, though much more kind of skeletal. And just the lyrics, so she's got a great kind of John Kalish, you know, also Welsh, kind of, you know, sort of delivery, kind of stentorian. And, you know, like, I'm a buddy of dreams for you, this kind of stuff. And it's really these kind of love songs delivered in this way. Like, they're, you know, it's very sweet and very sort of pointed and sweet at the same time. And these kind of guitars herk and jerk back and forth. And
I love the song you pulled out, Wonderful.
That's kind of the rocker. Yeah. It kind of comes out of there. But there's other ones that are a little less like that. But, yeah, it has a saxophone on it, which is very post-punk saxophones. It's kind of blare at the sort of in the middle.
I hear a little Stereo Lab here, too. Like, she kind of reminds me of, like, Letitia Sadie. Yeah. And what's the rest of the album like? You're saying this is the most rocking song?
This sort of is. The rest of them go to different places, I guess. But they're of a piece, you know. She is a funny songwriter in a certain sense. Some of the lyrics are kind of like, I've been trying to make sense of this. And she's talking about a relationship, putting a very, very fine point on some of this romantic stuff in a kind of conversational but also sort of detached kind of way. It's a fun delivery she has.
All right. So we'll look forward to the full album coming out. And then the last song is just, like, one of the most, like, fun hip-hop songs I've heard in a long time, Broccoli by Dram. John, do you want to talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, it's just one of these really great, euphoric, screwball kind of hip-hop songs. It kind of recalls the Bismarcky, euphoric, absurdist kind of hip-hop. It's this guy, Dram, who's a Virginia rapper who had a hit a couple years ago with a song called Cha-Cha. Which,
well, actually, let's stop for a minute, because that's worth talking about. Like, Cha-Cha like was definitely a hit a couple years ago, and a lot of people talk about how Drake kind of almost like remixed Cha-Cha for Hotline Bling.
I mean, this the sort of loungy little bit in Hotline Bling that kind of reminds me. Actually, it's funny you brought up Stereolab. I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, oh, it kind of reminds me. It's that comes from this, and it's very reference or even kind of some have said a ripoff of this Cha-Cha song. This song is definitely kind of like a post I'm famous song. And it's, you know, with hip hop so often, it's like, oh, you know, I'm rich. And it's such a drag to have an airplane made of elephant ivory. In this case, it's like, I'm rich. I'm going to get out there and I'm going to spend money. There's one great line where he talks about eating off of square plates and the looks he gets in the restaurants and stuff like that. And like, I'm going to go and blow 10 grand, right? And I'm going to light it on fire. And it's just this sort of incredible enthusiasm for this moment. And it's got a kind of great piano flute kind of loop. It's almost like a brunch kind of element to it. It's like trap music, but you could, you know, Sunday morning trap music. It's like a great song.
It's like a great summer song, and I'm glad that Dram's having his moment.
I'm a real young nigga from the sixth on balls. Real young nigga from the sixth on balls.
In the middle of the party, bitch, get off me.
Goddamn.
In the cut, I'm rolling up my...
There's maybe a little bit of bitterness when Hotline Bling was like the biggest song in the world. Yeah. It still practically is one of the biggest songs in the world, and Dram was playing in some Toronto club that night and went on social media saying, I'm feeling a little bittersweet about this.
Yeah, but history has not passed him by. This is a great song, yeah.
And it's always a good message to get there about broccoli out there. Only so many hip-hop
songs
vegetables. About broccoli. So. Well, anyway, Zusie Exposito, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
John Dolan, thank you.
Thank you.
You know, these days you can get practically everything on demand, like this podcast, music, digital magazines, just about anything. So why are you still making time-consuming trips to the post office when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. If you have your own business, maybe your own record label, perhaps a magazine you're starting, or a website, I would sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code MUSIC for this special offer. You get a four-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. None of those old-school scales with, like, the weights on one side involving ink and all that. So go to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in MUSIC. That's as in Rolling Stone Music Now. You'll be showing some love for us, and you'll be happy with it.
Come on up for the rise. Come on up, lay hands in mine. Come on up.
And that was Bruce Springsteen performing The Rising. We're playing that because Bruce Springsteen was just in the news for canceling a show in North Carolina in response to the state's new LGBT law. And the reason we're talking about that is that we're going to talk about a pretty huge issue: musicians and activism and politics. And when should rockers and other musicians get involved with politics and when they shouldn't? Does it work? Does it not work? When does it work? And to talk about this, I have Patrick Doyle, associate editor.
Hi.
I have Tessa Stewart, who's a staff writer for RollingStone.com who covers politics and national affairs.
Hello.
And I have John Dolan, contributing editor at Rolling Stone and record reviews editor.
Hey.
Hey. Thanks for coming, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No problem.
So, Patrick, can you tell me a little bit about just the basic facts of what happened with Bruce to kick things off?
Well, Bruce was supposed to play in Greensboro, North Carolina, and he canceled the show very shortly before it was supposed to happen because he didn't agree with a law called HB2, which is known as the bathroom law, which, among other horrible things, sort of says that transgender people need to go back to using the bathroom that is on their
original birth certificate. Right.
Yeah. Bruce canceled the show completely, took a big financial hit, wrote a letter on his website explaining his reasoning of why he was canceling the show, and it sort of set off a huge ripple in the music industry.
It was huge national news. I mean, it was all over the New York Times.
Yeah, it was a huge story, and a lot of people followed. Ringo Starr came after that, canceling, you know. Duran Duran went ahead and played their show, but they did certain things. Mumford and Sons.
Did Duran Duran change their show, or did they take any flack?
They met with a group that basically there's a there are some groups that say you should come and play our state because you need to use your voice to speak out on the issue. And they sort of view it as sort of cowardly to, you know, not play the show and move on.
Right.
So Duran Duran met with one of those groups who basically suggested that they donate a lot of the proceeds of the show to lobbying against this bill.
Right.
And then met with certain groups and things like that.
Right.
So basically, there's a big controversy right now. You know, Pearl Jam have a show coming out in a couple days, and they still haven't said anything of what they're going to do. So
I guess maybe we'll know by the time this podcast airs.
Yeah, I guess
what
we will. Yeah.
Check rollingstone.com for the latest updates. But I mean, this is a huge issue because this is something where people get, I won't say passionate, but they definitely, people have opinions about whether musicians or celebrities in general, but especially musicians, should get involved in politics. Some people have a real visceral negative reaction against it. Some people have a positive reaction. Tessa, from your perspective as someone who covers politics and like national affairs, when do you think it works? When doesn't it?
I think that it works for raising consciousness about the issue. I don't know how much of a hit it'll give the economy in the area where Bruce Springsteen was supposed to play, or Jimmy Buffett, or Ringo Starr, or whoever, these people who were boycotting it.
Right.
And there are people who take the other tack, like against me, Laura Jane Grace said she was going to play, and said the band was going to play, and Brandi Carlile and Cyndi Lauper.
Just to jump in, sorry to interrupt, but Laura Jane Grace is a LGBT mm-hmm. star herself. She's a trans, and she used to be in... Is she still with Against Me? I actually forgot.
Yeah, still Against Me.
Yeah, but and so she has a special perspective on this. Obviously.
Right, right. So she transitioned pretty publicly. And so there are people that are coming out and saying, we're going to donate the proceeds from our shows to LGBT organizations in North Carolina. So I think that there you can see it go either way. But to go back to my original point, I think that what it does, what Bruce Springsteen canceling a show there does is start a national dialogue about it, which I do think is really important.
It's kind of like, as I was saying, sort of a trend that began. You know, I think one of the first ones was recently, at least, with Stevie Wonder after the Trayvon Martin decision, mm-hmm. said, I'm not going to play any state with the law, the open...
Stand Your Ground.
Stand Your Ground, and Florida. Yeah,
right.
Florida especially, which is a huge market for music, and it's a beloved American figure saying, I'm not going to go to your state. Wilco had the same thing. They passed a religious liberty law in Indiana, and Wilco said we weren't going to play a show there. Then I guess they sort of modified it a little, and they said, okay, we'll go back. Then there's Bryan Adams recently in Mississippi said, right after the Springsteen thing, actually, they have another religious liberty law, and he said, I'm not going to play there. So it's something that a lot of musicians have decided to do, and
to
I think
Arizona.
You're right. Yeah, what happened in Arizona, was it, who was,
Kanye, and a lot of people, Connor Oberst, Sonic Youth.
Yeah. Like Zach De La Rocha really led that effort in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like Rage Against the Machine.
And I feel like all of them succeeded to different degrees, I feel like when it does succeed, just to jump in, it feels like when they do succeed, it turns a state almost into like South Africa during apartheid.
No, that's exactly exactly true. It's like it just sort of, it's, you know, the governor's not going to wake up and go, oh, geez, we got to reverse this law. Let's call an emergency session and get everyone in there. The boss is mad. But I think there is a sense of just feeling like, you know, if you want to be part of the American conversation culturally, if you want to be part of American life in your state, like we're going to pull out. You know, we're not going to be part of, we're not going to, you know, really include you in the conversation everyone else is having. You're going to be an anathema. And I think that is, I think in some places it matters more than others. But I think it seems like it's being effective. It does suggest sort of like a little bit of a tipping point sometimes. The Springsteen thing is a good example. It's like now the governor's saying he wants to have a conversation about it and sort of drawing it, stepping back a little bit. And who knows what will actually happen, but it's a powerful statement, I think, and can have real impact, even if it doesn't actually reverse the law or change the law.
Everybody keeps saying that Bruce, you know, the people who are opposed to what he did, they're saying that he should have just used the stage as a platform to speak about it, but... Every show, I mean, since the Born in the USA tour, he's spoken for, you know, local charity.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have had the impact that it did.
I think one other way that you've seen it really have an impact is in South Carolina, where the governor, Nikki Haley, has said that she won't be considering, like, a similar law there because she thinks it's such a bad idea. And she really came out and said that after Bruce Springsteen started this conversation.
So that's a really concrete accomplishment.
Yeah. And that's the kind of state where they would do it pretty quick. You know, it's like kind of interesting. Like culturally,
that would be
that's
at risk. Yeah, definitely.
Well, let's take a minute and go into a little bit of the history of musicians, or, you know, I should say major musicians being activists, and look at kind of how successful they've been over the past. John, you and I were talking a little bit about some of the most famous examples. Like, can you mention some of the...
I think the first big example was there was a concert in the late 70s, No Nukes. People like James Taylor, Bonnie Raitt, Springsteen played at that as well. It was for an organization called Musicians United for Safe Energy right after the Three Mile Island disaster.
Yeah.
And that was to raise awareness and raise money. And then, of course, obviously, We Are the World, which was basically a generous act of kind of, getting all these people together to sort of raise money. And that was kind of followed, interestingly, because, it was by this, like you mentioned, Sun City, which was supposed to be a little more pointed. It was the sort of birth of this, I think, where it was like musicians were going to Sun City, a big casino, kind of a Vegas, where they would bring in musicians. And all these musicians got together. It was organized by Steve Van Zandt, and Arthur Baker, a producer, organized it and got
who
a
actually
lot of,
is in the E Street Band.
Right, exactly. And so, soul musicians and new hip-hop musicians and also rockers. Dylan was involved. Ringo Starr was involved. You kind of see the echoes of now, and sort of recorded this song called Ink in a Place on City, which was a pretty big single. It got into the top 40. It even did better overseas, and it sort of was just putting pressure on the government there, and it was part of this broader cultural boycott of South Africa that the African National Congress had declared, which was Nelson Mandela's blanket sort of tent group, had declared a cultural boycott and sort of trying to get everyone to stay out. The most notable exception of people who didn't stay out was Paul Simon, who recorded Graceland there.
Right. I would add, you did a nice rundown of the major instances of this, except I would add one more, the concert for Bangladesh.
It was also more kind of like raising awareness and raising money. There's no real sort of like, I don't think it had much to do with pressuring the government of, you know what I mean?
Oh, interesting. You're right. It was a pure benefit.
Yeah, it was a benefit.
I
think one of the biggest moves, and you talk about sort of the efficacy of these things and whether, is making it specific, not just like a concert against depression, but like really picking something that happened somewhere and saying, I can specifically use my clout, like you just say economic clout in this case of Springsteen, where your town's going to lose money if I don't come. But sort of being very specific of a specific issue, a specific sort of piece of legislation, which is kind of new for rock activism, because I think going back to the 60s and 70s and 80s, it was often tended to be kind of, Live Aid.
Well, I mean, Tessa, from your perspective, like more of a political perspective, when do you think musicians aren't effective as activists? Or Patrick, I'll throw it open to the group.
Well, I mean, there's been people like Neil Young who have dedicated their whole, last decade of their career to entire albums of whether it's Monsanto Years or, a whole album about his, electric car and things like that. And that can, when that starts to dominate the artistic message, it can be sort of, but then there's the Dixie Chicks. I mean, there's a lot of,
Right. I would say from my perspective, often when musicians have to do a lot of spokesperson type activity, often if there are some musicians who can kind of pull it off. I mean, like Bono is someone who obviously is pointed at a lot as someone who goes to the Davos conference and can talk about
a lot of issues.
Right. Yeah. Every musician is as learned as Bono about the issues. And often, like, as you say, people were saying to Bruce Springsteen, maybe you should have just played the show and spoken on stage about it. Often musicians don't sound great when they speak on stage. They often, they're talking from an emotional perspective and don't always have the command of the issues. I'm speaking kind of in broad terms.
Right. Well, what Patrick pointed out is really good at this sort of symbolism of Springsteen going like, this one's for the governor. It's like, well, he's done that exactly for 30 years or whatever. Yeah. It doesn't really have the impact. It wouldn't have made news. It would have been mentioned in the concert review. Yeah. He also sort of made it, but it would have had no impact at all. This thing clearly made some kind of, at least symbolic, but maybe even actual difference in changing people's opinions.
I was just going to say, to answer your question, I think that one of the ways they're less effective is in political endorsements. Bernie rolled out this list of 150 musicians that were supporting him, and a lot of them were really high profile people, but I don't think very many people are like, oh, if
the Ezra Kane swung the Vampire Weekend
Grizzly
vote.
Grizzly Bear played this thing yesterday in Brooklyn. Right. It's like, well, he's got the Grizzly Bear vote. So he's good to go.
And maybe they're turning people out. Maybe people are excited to see Grizzly Bear's first show.
I was actually at that rally in Prospect Park, and a lot of the people there looked like Grizzly Bear fans.
Wow.
So
there might
have been some overlap, or maybe they just turned out for Bernie because they wanted to see Grizzly Bear.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense because I think, if anything, the only thing maybe it shows when musicians endorse specific candidates is in the case of Bernie, it shows that he has a lot of younger musicians or musicians with younger appeal or more, I don't want to say hipster appeal or more alternative appeal. So I could see why maybe college campuses might respond to that, like, oh, the kind of the bands I like and respond to, more of them like Bernie, as opposed to, like, if you look at Hillary Clinton's musician supporters, it's like Katy Perry and Demi Lovato, a little more mainstream. And
the caveat there is that I do think that Killer Mike has been a really effective surrogate for Bernie, especially because he has struggled to get black voters turning out for him. And I think that Killer Mike has done a lot of outreach on his behalf that's been really effective. And he's been a consistent presence on the campaign trail. And
Killer Mike of Run the Jewels. And
Bernie introduced him at Coachella this weekend. There was like a video introduction from Bernie for Run the Jewels performance at Coachella, which I think is
pretty
like
awesome.
Really good for Bernie to have that kind of exposure.
For sure.
And like brand alignment, I guess.
For sure. And Killer Mike has really put in the legwork, for sure. Yeah, as you say, like, I mean, he's very focused and given a lot of speeches, and obviously he's up on most of the issues.
I was thinking about something I did a story about a couple years ago with the West Memphis Three, as far as musicians getting behind a cause and it being successful, because Eddie Vedder and Johnny Depp, but also Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks, all got behind these three teenagers who were put away for 20 years. Music that they listened to was used against them, and, you know, people thought they were involved in, like, satanic rituals and stuff. But then Natalie Maines played a huge part in she wrote a blog post, and the father of one of these kids who the Paradise Lost films sort of suggested he was involved. He basically had to give a deposition that contradicted what he had said years earlier and got these guys out of jail. So that, I thought, was a very successful situation.
Right. So it seems to be like the consensus among our expert panel is that musicians tend to do better when they have a very focused issue, maybe raising awareness about very targeted issues, maybe raising money if you can include that.
Yeah, that would help. Yeah.
But perhaps endorsements not so much.
Concert for Bangladesh didn't make anything, and they
yeah. Well, there's always that risk.
They didn't know where the money was going, and
right.
Yeah, that was a criticism of Live Aid too. Remember, it was kind of like, it was after they realized like all this huge, it was the U.S. and England, was this massive event, but it ended up raising very little because just the logistics of putting it on were so expensive, I think.
And there have been a lot of issues. I can remember, you know, with Wyclef Jean of the Fugees. You know, he was very active after the earthquake in Haiti, but then there was a controversy about how much of his charity's money went to the actual victims.
Right.
Often we find that, like, rock stars or pop stars and, like, finances and budgets sometimes don't mix.
This is
a demographic of people who are known for spending a lot of money, and sometimes fundraising is not their forte for people other than themselves.
Yeah.
Trying to put this nicely.
Yeah, that's well said, I think.
All right, well, is there anything we didn't cover? Are there any, like, spectacular successes or failures with musicians in political causes or activism that we didn't throw in?
I mean, it backfired against the Dixie Chicks big time, you know, back in 2003 when they spoke out against President Bush, and they lost the sponsorships and ticket sales went way down. And
they kind of changed their whole career. You know, they decided, oh, no, now we're this kind of alternative, like, country band, a little more folky. It's like it was a real interesting, you're right, like, it sort of changed the trajectory of their entire, you know, it's hard to almost imagine her being such a West Memphis 3 person, actually, if she hadn't kind of fallen off the sort of track with Nashville.
Yeah.
It sort of just made their whole life, their whole sort of artistic life different.
Yeah.
There was just one other example that I thought of. Last month, SeaWorld announced that they were going to stop breeding orcas in captivity. And I don't know if this is really about the musicians who boycotted performances at SeaWorld, because SeaWorld was hosting a lot of concerts, and there were a bunch of musicians, Bare Naked Ladies, Martina McBride, Cheap Trick, Trisha Yearwood, Willie Nelson, Heart, that all canceled performances at SeaWorld. But I think it was more directly tied to Blackfish, to the documentary.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of musicians canceled their performances after that.
But I feel like the musicians...
documentary came out.
Right, yeah. But I feel like the musicians canceling were kind of, like the North Carolina thing, a sign that, like, okay, this is beyond the pale. This is something that... if you care about, if you're a part of the cultural life.
If the Bare Naked Ladies won't take a payday, they need the money. You know, it's like, they don't want to go. It's like, we better do something about this.
And I think the economic impact for SeaWorld was probably big. Like, those concerts bring in a lot of people to their facility, and it was probably a material impact for them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. All right. Well, then we'll leave it at that. So, Patrick Doyle.
Thanks.
Tessa Stewart.
Thank you.
John Dolan.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming.
You bet.
Here in the fields,
That was The Who's Baba O'Reilly. And The Who are one of many, many huge rock acts who may be playing out in a field in Indio, California, in what looks to be the biggest classic rock concert ever. Jason Newman from RollingStone.com is here to tell us a little more about this. Jason, can you say what's happening here?
Yeah, so it's either the death knell of classic rock or the greatest night in classic rock history. So you have Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Roger Waters, and The Who all are in talks. It has not been confirmed yet, but all in talks to do a Coachella-type three-day festival, so it would be two acts over 3 days each, in the same area as Coachella, run by Golden Voice and AEG. And they are in the works. Neil Young's manager has confirmed that at least Neil is in, and we're all kind of waiting for...
And Neil Young's manager, Elliot Roberts, was the one who kind of spilt the beans.
This is right.
The, he was one of, to Billboard, we should give them credit.
Billboard and Los Angeles Times, both. Right. He's the only one to go on the record and say this is actually happening.
Right.
But I think as... To the best of everyone's knowledge, everything is still kind of in the works, but it seems like it's a go if all the money is right for everyone.
It's looking pretty serious, yes,
right.
And it just looks like it could happen. So needless to say, this set the rock world and the classic rock world
right.
a buzz and a Twitter over yes. the weekend. We're going to answer some reader mail about this and maybe get at some of the kind of questions having to do with this. Okay, here's a question from JD Jr., or a comment. Gee, I wonder how many face value tickets will be available for quote-unquote normal buyers when the electronic ticket window opens. Okay, well, that kind of gets at the $64 question, or maybe the much higher value question.
Right.
What are tickets going to be for this? Are you ready to venture a guess?
I am. I've thought long and hard about this over the weekend since I don't do much else, and I'm putting it at about $800 or $900 for the
wow.
3 days. That's what I'm guessing. I think... With the economics involved of bringing all these guys together, I just don't see feasibly how you even go anything less than, you know, $600 or $700 for a regular ticket. The thing with this, though, is that because a lot of the fans of a lot of these bands are a little older and have a little more income, my guess is you're going to see a huge ton of all these VIP packages, cabana packages,
these
giant
could be the
pool packages, RV packages.
The mothers of all golden circles.
Yeah,
for
so
this. Yeah.
You're going to probably see these, like, these price points where it starts at a certain level, but then, just like any other festival, but just on steroids, you're going to see these, like, probably, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 packages where you get all inclusive everything. You know, they know who their audience is.
This demographic is kind of the concert sweet spot. Like,
right.
These are the people, you know, the Stones are infamous for offering, you know, well, they're well known for making sure their tickets are being sold for the market value.
Sure. They're capitalists. Yes.
Stones fans tend to be well-heeled people these days, or right. people in their prime earning years. Who are willing to pay $250, right. $350, $450 for a ticket.
And by all accounts, this is not going to be a tour of any kind. This will be, you know, the one 3 day weekend you'll be able to see all of these acts together. So, you know, they'll definitely be hyping this as a global destination spot for rock fans around the world to travel as sort of this classic rock mecca in the same way that, you know, Coachella in its early years was for alternative music.
And again, I don't want to get you in trouble here, Jason Newman, but, like, would you even be willing to guess what some of these bands are making or artists are making for a gig like this?
There were early estimates, and of course this is unconfirmed, there were early estimates that it was looking at about $4 to $5 million per group.
Well, that sounds right,
yeah.
Because Coachella headliners can make around in the vicinity of $2 or $3 million.
Yeah, it's you know, about $2 million
at,
is
at the
there.
Top tier.
Right.
This is kind of a Coachella on steroids in the sense that it's a kind of a once in a lifetime thing.
Right. And they will, you know, obviously they'll be certainly hyping up the fact that, I mean, you really, if this does go off, you will never see this lineup combined ever again.
Right.
It's just not feasible. So
right.
they will definitely be hyping that up a lot.
Well, let's answer some more reader mail. Okay, this is from a commenter named Toby. They should add David Gilmour. He just blew minds across the country, including this one in NYC. Why isn't David Gilmour there?
Well,
I don't know if we can venture to guess, but do you have any opinions on this?
We could take one shot. There is a man named Roger Waters,
oh.
who he shared the bill with for a very popular band, who is allegedly confirmed for the bill. It has always been a little odd between Waters and Gilmore, so it's very possible that they don't want to share the stage.
Who knows? But, we don't want to speculate, but could have been a deal breaker.
Drake brought out Madonna last year. Guns N' Roses brought out Angus. Maybe Roger buries the hatchet again and brings out David. And
maybe they'll just be a David Gilmore hologram for this. Yeah.
Tim and Tupac.
Okay, another commenter asking or commenting, get in Brian Wilson as well. And there's actually another commenter, 7up17 to go is the username saying, wouldn't it be nice if the Beach Boys were there? Question mark, question mark, question mark.
Which iteration of the Beach Boys?
Right, and that might be too much to ask because Brian Wilson and I know Mike Love just did a tour together, and I think Mike Love broke it off. There might be a little bit of animus there. Again, we don't want to speculate, but it's...
And I would say to 7up17 to go, if that is your Christian name, how much more do you need? There's so much good stuff on this bill. Like, you could play that game forever where it's, you know, why isn't so-and-so on the bill? And who knows, maybe they add acts to this, but I don't know. It's a pretty solid lineup so far if you're a rock fan.
This is the final comment from a user named Dexsoft. If they're going to have these artists from the 60s, then why not include black artists? The same time the Beatles, Dylan, the Stones, and the Who were selling millions of records, so were the Temptations, the Four Tops, the Supremes, Aretha Franklin, Gladys Knight, Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Curtis Mayfield, and more. Funny how the music that most of the rock bands copied on their way to fame is now ignored. All right, I'll field this. I would say, in fairness to the organizers of this, the full lineup has not been announced. So we really, it's a little unfair to criticize them for the people who aren't there when they haven't actually said anything official.
Right.
But I think Dexsoft makes an excellent point.
I would agree. And a lot of the acts that he mentioned that are playing now in their current iterations are probably playing theaters, you know, in the 1,000 to 1,500 range. So it is, you know, there's something to be said for the fact that a lot of these, you know, black artists from the 50s and 60s who are still doing it now are playing much smaller venues, but it probably warrants a much bigger conversation.
I could also say there are a lot of artists who are playing bigger venues who could be there. Somebody like Stevie Wonder would be amazing.
Absolutely.
So we'll see. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt. So, Jason, I expect you to be tracking this in the coming months, and you'll be keeping us posted.
The senior geriatric correspondent.
That's right. Thank goodness you're on the case.
No worries.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks.
And that's it for Rolling Stone Music Now. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts, and read more about all these stories on rollingstone.com or in Rolling Stone Magazine.